The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member at TNTRadio.live. Speaking on the issues that impact, this is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
All right, right. Look, hour number two, and we got a bit of a holdover here. We're going to bring in Basil Valentine. He's still on the line, our intrepid culture and sport correspondent. He's checking out the political situation in France, and he's also surveying the culture in France and no doubt probably enjoying it a little bit during his busy schedule. I'm also joined in studio here with Rick Munn, the host of Locked and Loaded on TNT Radio. Give us the broadcast times again for your show, Rick.
Okay, it's 10 a.m. until 12 p.m. UK time, so 5 hours behind for East Coast time, 8 hours behind West Coast time in America, and all sorts of times for Australia and any other business, any other places. So UK, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., Monday through Friday.
And Nancy, you go for all stories, don't you? There's no niche focus, is it? You do everything.
Whatever's happening, usually on the day within 24 hours, on issues like trans issues or economics, we cover everything.
So yeah, you're reacting and commenting on the news cycle real time.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about this trans shooter thing. This is a huge story on so many different levels, because and then the reaction of it as well. And you were saying before the break, Rick, that mainstream media are like issuing apologies. What could they possibly be apologizing about?
Well, the New York Times, just for reference purposes, the New York Times put an apology out today, and I'll quote it. They said there was confusion on Monday about the gender identity of the assailant in the Nashville shooting. Officials had used she and her to refer to the suspect, who, according to a social media post and their LinkedIn profile, appeared to identify as a man in recent months. Now, this was a biological female. It was a woman, but because they referred to themselves on LinkedIn as he, him, now we have the New York Post apologizing for any confusion for misgendering her, or him, as they say, as a her, which she was. Very confusing, Patrick, very confusing. But that was the New York Times today.
So here's the thing that I never see talked about. Like, and what they said before on the top of their news headline, saying, was there a history of mental illness? They're asking the cops at the press conference. Of course they're mentally ill. If they're going on a Rambo style shooting spree, and they've got a gender body dysphoria condition, they're clearly completely bonkers, like totally nuts. So that shouldn't even be in the conversation. The real question is, and of course, as a journalist, I want to know, are they taking any prescription medication like SSRIs, Adderall, Xanax, all that sort of stuff? Because that induces psychosis or other drugs that might be involved, but especially prescription drugs. And why doesn't the media ever do that? How come the media never asks that question? It's always off limits. Does it have anything to do with the fact that one of the biggest advertisers for the mainstream media is the pharmaceutical industry in America? I'm just throwing that out there, folks.
Yeah, well, that's what Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene is asking. She tweeted out, how much hormones like testosterone and medications for mental illness was the transgender Nashville school shooter taking? And of course, she's been attacked for asking that question.
Ridiculous. So you want to get to the bottom of it. You want to find out what the actual mechanisms are for some of these things. And so you have across the country, massive amount of resources and schools, counseling, and the medical industry and the counseling industry is all geared up to promote trans and put kids on this track for, you know, gender reassignment and, you know, girls removing their breasts or guys doing female transitions and all this stuff. So, and then they're all on meds, like more than a high percentage of these people are on SSRIs or on antipsychotic medication. This is not a bug. It's a feature of society now. Teachers are on the same pills as well. They're whacked out on drugs, half of them. Everybody is. So don't you see there's a systemic risk here that you have whole bands of society that are hopped up on something or rather mind-altering drugs, and then they're undergoing these radical political identity. Body dysphoria used to be a mental condition. It was a mental illness. And now that's been muted, and all of a sudden it's being celebrated as this wonderful liberation, and I was born in the wrong body and all this stuff. I mean, this is just getting like absolutely crazy. Aside from the shooting, we have a mental, this is not going to help. These trends do not help the mental illness curve. It's growing because of it. It's not reducing it. But they keep telling us, guys, they say, oh, we need to do this for their well-being, right? The whole thing seems backwards, Rick.
When the Tavistock Clinic was being investigated, I mean, figures were coming out about the kids that were being treated in Tavistock. So the vast majority of the children that presented there with body dysphoria, they wanted gender reassignment surgery. They were young to begin with, but they were also suffering, most of them, from at least two mental illnesses or conditions that were detrimental to their mental health. It could have been eating disorders. It could have been depression. Many of the kids that identify as trans are autistic at the same time. So none of this was identified or they didn't try and treat that or address that issue. They just simply said, well, listen, you know your own body. You know, you're 7 years of age. You're big enough to make your own decisions in that you can't vote. You can't drive a car. You don't have a national insurance number. You can't even buy a lottery ticket. But if you want to have a double mastectomy, you want to have top surgery, you want to have a penectomy, you want to have the skin removed from your forearm to make a phallus that doesn't work anyway, will probably become infected. This is what they're pushing on children. And you wonder why this curve is going up exponentially among our nation's youth. It is an all-out assault on their mental health. They're not helping these children at all. They are damaging them and mutilating them in the name of inclusivity and sacrificing them on the altar of woke.
Legalized institutional child abuse.
Yes.
To put it, go ahead, Basil.
It's satanic. It's as simple as that, because it is anti-nature. It is, it's interesting that, well, interesting, tragic, awful, that it was a Christian school that was targeted by this individual, which is just absolutely atrocious, but indicative of the mindset of some members, at least, of the transgender community. I mean, the simple fact is that, as we've said before, you know, 50 years ago, one in 100,000 people or something identified as transgender, and it's now become an epidemic. That isn't because there are these people, you know, more people are simply being honest about it or anything like that. Far from it. It's because of a mind virus, really, which has taken hold and been encouraged. I mean, there was a very interesting article which I will share on Twitter about who's been funding these transgender clinics, which have absolutely mushroomed all over the United States. And as Rick said, it's a species of mental illness. But there's a mental illness epidemic in the United States as well as a transgender epidemic. And a lot of them are on the streets. You know, I mean, from my experience of the United States recently, it really is descending into a third world country, because you still have some fabulously rich people, of course, but, you know, third world countries are characterized not by the existence of a tiny minority of extremely wealthy, but by overall standards of social cohesion and public services and public infrastructure. And the infrastructure in the United States is completely crumbling. You know, airports, roads, bridges, nothing is ever spent on anything public. It's taken them 40 years to try and build a railway between Los Angeles and San Francisco, and they still haven't managed to do it. And yet China's built tens of thousands of miles of high-speed rail in the last 15 years, connecting every major city and town you could possibly imagine, a huge network. So, I mean, you know, thousands on the living on the streets in Portland, apparently they've completely given up policing whole districts. The homeless have now moved into the suburbs and are attacking residents, and you know, it's unfortunately it's a society in a state of semi-collapse. They printed $8 trillion, gave people 1,400 quid each, and rampant inflation. You know, it's a total disaster.
And look, if remember the Canadian truckers protest, and some clown who's masked, don't know who he was, shows up with a Confederate flag, starts waving the Confederate flag around, and immediately heads of state, Trudeau, and others say, we will not bow to hate and these Nazis and whatever. And here, and so that's the reaction from the press, from the political people on this. And then you have an actual terrorist attack. This is a trans terrorist. And they
The Christian school was identified and targeted because it was a Christian school. So therefore, that is a form of terrorism, isn't it? Isn't that one of the sort of litmus tests of terrorism, you know, that a particular group have been targeted for terrorism?
No, even more so, the people defending it are saying that the reason that they've gone on a shooting spree is because the state didn't allow unbridled, access to all these surgery for children, and children should not be restricted, and nobody should be restricted to do anything. And if you don't allow unbridled madness on the, gender fluidity spectrum activity and whatnot, then you can expect these types of attacks. That's terrorism. This is the same sort of arguments that any other terrorist would make. Mm-hmm. So how is that any different? And Stop Cop City is this other organization. I think this was in Georgia. There's terrorism charges coming on the organizers of that because they actually carried out a terrorist attack. And so there was a Trans Day of Vengeance, which was advertised outside the Supreme Court. And it was right around this time as well. So this is a radical, violent, threatening violence against the state, against people, against institutions. But it's treated, but the media is like, no, we need to understand them. We need to be more sensitive. How could this have happened? Let's just rack our brains. Somebody went wrong somewhere along the system. This poor person, if they were, identified as being on the right, it would have been far right, Trump radicalized, lock them up, kill them, whatever, euthanize them. That's the general establishment reaction.
There's something else here that's just as you guys are talking that's coming into my head. Think about the years that women's rights groups spent campaigning against female genital mutilation in sub-Saharan African countries. It was an abomination. It was an assault on young girls to perform surgery against their will, to mutilate their bodies for life. That was something that was a horrific, it still is a horrific practice and a horrific topic, but it seems to be that switch of horror is deactivated when maybe some of these activists' own daughters or sons are coming to them and said, I want to go for top surgery. I don't want to just have something done in my lower half. I want to have my breasts removed. I want to have, if they're a boy, I want to have my genitals removed. The horror doesn't seem to be there in the same way that it was when it was happening, as Basil said, in third world countries. You know, all of a sudden, it's almost like we're embracing that third world practice, but we're packaging it up as something that's socially acceptable and inclusive. And because it's happening in the West, it's not horrific anymore. It's something that should be allowed and something that should be facilitated. But in Somalia, in parts of northern Kenya, among the Maasai tribe, among the Turkana, it's horrific. It's barbarous practice to do that to a young girl, but not if she's in the Tavistock Clinic. It's perfectly acceptable. The hypocrisy is off the scale.
That's right. It's progressive. It's progressive. It's inclusive. Basil, we got a minute left before we go to break, and we're going to let you go, but give us your final thoughts on this issue.
Well, I want to give you my final thoughts on that issue. That is absolutely tragic. And as you said, the spin on the story has been completely bent out of shape. But I just want to get one more story in quickly, which you might want to pick up after the break, which is the attempt to introduce roadblock planters in Rochdale, people, of all places, in the Deeplish and Milkstone area of Rochdale. This is, of course, the part of the so-called active neighborhood trial, which encourages people not to drive, all part of, zero, net zero, and Agenda 2030 and all the rest of it. And in a suburban street in Rochdale, a town which straddles the Lancashire-Yorkshire border in the north of England, what they do is, and they're going to do the same thing in Canterbury and Oxford, is put these huge planters in the middle of the road, which are supposed to prevent people driving down the road. Well, everywhere they've been put, they've been smashed up, set fire to, people drive on the pavement, you name it. And the latest Daily Mirror in the United Kingdom is reporting, has a picture of one of these planters ablaze hours only after the scheme was launched. So be very interesting to see the extent to which the globalists, in the person of the various local councils that are pushing this through against local people's will, the extent to which they double down, or will they back down? That remains to be seen. Thank you, gentlemen, and I will see you on Thursday, Patrick.
Thank you very much.
Basil, lovely break.
Thank you very much, Basil Valentine. Sayonara, our roving correspondent for culture and sport. Enjoy your remaining time in France, and do give us any updates on the political situation there on the back line as well. We'll be looking forward to your comments and observations there. However, let's take a quick break with TNT Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen in studio with Rick Munn from Locked and Loaded. We will be back after these messages.
TNT Radio's Chris Smith.
Well, we're beginning to learn more about the impacts of COVID and all vaccines on the human body thanks to several embalmers across the world. Now, these funeral directors are now observing many large and abnormal clots inside the corpses they treat and are beginning to speak out, thankfully.
One of the main things for me was very early on in 2020 as a funeral director, I took a phone call, and this would have been about March time, from a guy called John. He said that he worked for a government-sponsored company, and that company, I believe, was called Pandemic Resilience. He started steering me almost immediately, and straight away this guy would insist this guy was COVID. And I kind of said, well, why? You know, I've told you the circumstances. And he said, well, we've been instructed that one person died from COVID in that facility. And this is a 350-bed facility, you know, it's huge. So he said that we've been instructed to label every person that dies in that facility a COVID death. Yeah, it was a joke. It was a joke.
Chris Smith on TNT Radio.
Google and Facebook, they don't sell you anything. They sell you.
Facebook constantly manipulates their users. They do it by the things that they insert into the news feeds, and they do it by the types of hosts they allow their users to see.
It's what Google and Facebook are doing on a regular basis, by suppressing stories, by steering us towards other stories rather than the stories we're actually seeking. That's the real manipulation that's going on.
I was a design ethicist at Google, where I studied how do you ethically steer people's thoughts.
It will always favor one online music service over another and one candidate over another.
Google and Facebook
has the power to undermine democracy without us knowing that democracy has been undermined.
There's what I call the creepy line, and the Google policy about a lot of these things is to get right up to the creepy line but not cross it.
Google crosses the creepy line every day.
Discover how society is manipulated by Google and Facebook. The creepy line at salemnow.com.
Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
All right, folks. We're getting into it here in the second hour of this live broadcast. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. I'm joined in studio by a very special comrade in arms, Rick Munn, on the information war. He is out there on the wild plains of the information badlands, fighting it out with on his own, if necessary, equipped with only a sharp mind and a quick wit and ability to be a top raconteur. It's a pleasure, Rick, to be joining you this week.
Thank you for the invitation. It's always nice to hook up with you when you're in town. And hopefully it won't be another 12 months before you're back again.
Indeed, indeed. And joining us on the line as well to give some commentary on the economic situation, we're going to bring in Blake Lovewell in just a minute. We'll be able to pull him in here on the technology on the board. We'll see if we can pull Blake in. So there's a lot to talk about in terms of the economy. And also we're going to talk about, did you notice Zelensky, you know, the sort of the parade of celebrities, politicians, the latest one to show up at Zelensky Palace in Kiev is none other than Orlando Bloom. Mm-hmm. So the elves of Rivendell have sent Legolas. So it's just all perfect, isn't it? Light the fires of Gondor, the orcs in the east, and the whole thing's amazing, isn't it?
I don't know if you've seen what he gifted Zelensky. Obviously, Sean Penn rocked up and he gifted him his Oscar. He, because obviously he's one of the best actors on the planet, I think he deserved the Oscar. But Orlando Bloom came up and gifted him some Buddhist philosophy from his Buddhist mentor. And Natalie and I were discussing this on the show a few days ago. She practices Buddhism. She said one of the main tenets of Buddhism is you have to get along with people. You have to seek peace at every opportunity. So it's kind of hard to square that Buddhist circle with Orlando Bloom coming to Zelensky in Kiev or wherever it is they hooked up. It could have been somewhere else, a bunker in Poland somewhere, and telling him to follow the path of Buddha. I would have thought the first thing he would have done was call an immediate ceasefire and seek to broker peace if he was being legitimate. Of course, it wasn't legitimate. It's just another gaslighting exercise, I think.
Well, I think, if I'm not mistaken, that Orlando Bloom is SGI Sakagai International Buddhism. So this is a lay Buddhist organization. So his mentor would be Deyasu Ikeda, the famous Japanese, the founder of that movement. And, you know, I know a lot of Buddhists who are in that organization, and some of them are just amazing, absolutely the most outstanding and amazing people I know. And I just find this a little bit disconcerting that someone would go and mix this proxy war in Ukraine. It's just it's carnage. What's going on is immoral. There's 170,000 odd dead Ukrainian soldiers. And on the Russian side, probably, you know, a fair few, 30 to 50,000, take your pick. All young men, some older men as well, fathers, sons, cousins. And this is being egged on by Washington and London. They don't want any peace negotiations. Rishi Sunak said, this is not the time for peace until we get victory. I mean, is this madness on a scale? This is like World War I, Battle of the Somme, total craziness. So as a Buddhist, Orlando Bloom should be showing up telling Zelensky, look, mate, let's take a beat now. It's time to stop.
Yeah.
How long is this bloodletting going to go on? So where is the Buddhist principles there? It's just the whole thing is insane. I'm very disturbed by this Orlando Bloom visit. And then just kowtowing to Zelensky, and they're both hamming it up for the cameras. It was just, it's embarrassing.
There seems to be no depth to which that man won't sink, which is Zelensky, you know, whether it be Vogue photo shoots, whether it be prancing around in his spandex or, you know, gyrating in his high heel shoes or playing a piano with his penis. I'm sorry to say that's what he's known for pre-February 22. Nobody even knew who he was. Most people had no idea where Ukraine was, let alone what a yellow and blue flag of Ukraine looked like at the football match. I don't know if you saw the Ukraine. Ukrainians playing, like, who fields a football team full of young, fit men when there's a war going on back home and you have people in the crowd with their yellow and blue flags with messages to Rishi Sunak saying, Rishi, please send the F-16s. Rod Stewart was appealing for F-16s. I don't think they understand that the British Air Force don't actually have any F-16s. I believe that's the domain of the American Air Force. They can't even get that right. Send the F-16s, Rishi. Rod Stewart, send the F-16s. It shows you how cooked that guy really is.
He's had too many booster shots, but nonetheless, he's gone the way of so many popular singers these days, really into the gutter of politics. But we're going to bring on Blake Lovewell. He's a writer for 21stCenturyWire.com. Now, Blake normally, Rick, has got a lot to say about the financial crash. We're talking about the banks, crypto, gold. So we will talk about money with Blake. Yeah. Let's bring him in here. But Blake, what do you think about the state of this Ukrainian, that the love affair with Ukraine, that the West has been told they must have this love affair since last year, and the flags flying over the hamlets and shires of England, town halls, municipal buildings, flying the standard of the royal standard of Kiev, the gold and the blue, in the windows of houses, and down in your neck of the woods on the South Coast, Blake, I see plenty of support for Ukraine. Where, how is that going right now in general, this whole, the Ukrainian love affair movement?
Yes. Hello, Rick, and hello, all the listeners. Yeah, let's dive right into it. Yeah, I'd say the flags are still there. The odd town hall still has them flying, although once they got quite tatty, some of them were removed. You'll often see a faded Ukraine flag in a car window, things like that. But I think the first surge, the first wave of support and propaganda has somewhat ebbed, I would say. There's still, obviously, that has left a completely astroturfed landscape behind it where there's no clear thought on the issue. As I've mentioned before, I have studied Ukraine in depth for many years before this conflict, before it was cool, I would like to claim, without bringing too much ego, if we're to pursue the Buddhist cause, which I think you're very right to raise. Because when we look at all of these issues, be they economic or war, it's often quite downbeat affair. But when we're looking at solutions, it's not always obvious. But then I think taking things on like Buddhist values of, having some reflection on things and minimizing your impact, not seeking to domineer people, things like that. That's a good start. In that vein, I've been tracking most on the day to day Ukraine news. My end is the UK sending depleted uranium shells and rounds to Ukraine, which is to me a big war crime. I don't know about to you guys, because it's been well known through their use in Eastern Europe as well as in Iraq that there are long-standing issues, not only for the victims but also for the perpetrators. If you're holding these rounds, loading them into tank cannons, you're receiving poisonous radiation poisoning and so on, and there's loads of different effects that being exposed to this depleted uranium can have. The army argues that these rounds are extremely effective at penetrating tank armor. I mean, good for you. But I think that the fact that in the modern era, when we're supposed to have sort of an illusion, at least, of international law, and things are supposed to be brought into a kind of, the media as the kind of third sector looking into these things, investigating and making judgment calls and maybe positing opinions. I see none of that. So even though the power of the Ukrainian flag and Slava Ukraini has faded, I think that in the background, the wheels are still spinning full motion. Like, you only had to witness Rishi at the Munich Security Conference, where he was saying, we need more tanks now, as soon as possible, and the UK will be the first, but when we blaze the trail, others will follow, trying to get Germany or America to follow on, trying to be the trendsetter. But we know that Rishi is well, he wasn't elected. Nobody voted for war with Ukraine in the UK, so they only rely on that the existing framework of domineering. And very recently, this week, or I think it was actually last Friday, but of the MOD, the UK Ministry of Defence, released a video about how the brave UK Army is training the brave. I'm adding these terms brave because the propaganda is completely sickening, but I'm trying to take a positive turn on things as well. But they released a video of them training Ukrainian troops and literally showing in the video depleted uranium rounds. And similarly, they also have on the shoulder of the Ukrainian troops that that troika symbol, the trifecta or the trident, which you often see on the Ukrainian flags that are presented around the UK, because that's the kind of rebellious wing. But to me, that smacks of exactly when we saw fake protests for in Syria, which were using the Syrian flag with three stars instead of two, which was the kind of the rebel flag. And when we say rebel, we're using that term in the way that the US government might call someone rebels when they're actually armed and funded terrorists. And so when I see someone waving that flag in the UK with no idea about what's going on in Ukraine, with this trident that basically symbolizes far right, Ukrainian nationalism, I think is very far off the point. And it kind of illustrates that in the information age, maybe not everything is immediately clear to people.
As I say, what's your comment on the depleted uranium side of things there?
Well, I want to throw thank you for that bit of analysis, Blake. I'm going to throw something in that a lot of people are not aware, but we're aware on this show and also at 21 Wire because of the great work of Freddie Ponton, the French journalist, who alerted us, and we published an expose in May 2022 about all the different weapons that contain depleted uranium that are already in Ukraine. The biggest offender is the French. The second is, so the Javelin missile systems, the anti-tank missile system, nobody talks about it, but the rounds and the ammunition that's loaded into that is often and is we would predict and guess those would be DU rounds. So that's for penetrating tank armor. Obviously, the Enlaw one, which is a Saab, the auto manufacturer, who's also a defense contractor. They're Swedish. The plant is in Ireland, in the south of Ireland. And that's the Enlaw, they call them. And so when Britain was shipping theirs, it's the 12.5 kilo Enlaw. It's a lightweight thing. So because it's lightweight and portable, the munition needs to be small and the most bang for the buck. And the only munition that you can have that does that is DU. So we're pretty certain that Britain via Sweden and the United States with the Javelins, the French had Javelins that they bought from America. They dumped all that stuff in Ukraine at the beginning of the war. So there's DU blowing around the farms and agricultural lands, seeping into the water supply and getting into the residents there, poisoning half a billion years half life. So you got to clean this stuff up. You got to have exclusion zones. Like if you don't, it's just going to basically be there forever. Long-term health effects. Whatever. Are they pricing this into the future of Ukraine? Totally insane, Blake. I don't know, Rick, if you got a comment on this issue.
Yeah, the DU business, it seems to be right off the bat. There's been provocation, poking. The first casualty, I think I keep saying in this conflict, was diplomacy. It was the first thing to go. I remember listening to you, Patrick. In fact, you came on my show right at the very, very beginning in January of last year, and you were talking about, you know, if sanctions are imposed, economic sanctions, it could be looked upon as an act of war. So right off the bat, it became clear that NATO didn't want to pursue diplomacy. They wanted to antagonize and hurt Russia. And of course, when they did apply sanctions and they started messing around with SWIFT, Biden was celebrating, the ruble was tanking. Then last April, I think it was, Putin played the masterstroke of said, well, if you want my gas, now you have to pay for it. And the ruble took off. And one thing and another, then you had the Nord Stream attack. You've had the depleted uranium. You've had armament sent there by NATO rather than putting troops on the ground. Constant provocation. But this depleted uranium business, it's a dirty move. It's almost like you were referencing the First World War earlier. It's almost like deploying mustard gas. It's just a nasty thing to do above and beyond the hatefulness and horrors of war. It's just taking it to another step. Not only does it hurt the people that it's hitting, it hurts the people that are loading it and using it, and it destroys the environment. Half-life of so many billion years, it's not going anywhere. It's going to pollute the ground, the water supply, the air possibly. This stuff doesn't go away. It's just a nasty move on so many levels. But of course, nothing's off the table when it comes to what's going on over there now. They want nothing more than Putin to take the bait here. This is a perfect way to do it. What better way to provoke him?
And Russia said that they're going to take this as an escalation on this. But yeah. Blake, we're going to go to a break real quick again. And I don't know do you want to opine on this, or have you got something else you want to share with us?
We could opine all day. I just wanted to bounce that back to
to Rick there, you said at the start, diplomacy was the first thing that died. And then I thought to myself, how is diplomacy possible in this situation in the Ukraine? And I'd probably open that up to you for an answer. Like, if you were to take, you know, an optimistic perspective, and if you had sort of some magical powers, how would you instigate diplomacy when there is a president in place who is pure actor in Ukraine, NATO is feeling unaccountable, and Russia is responding to whatever provocation? What do you think?
Two actors in the White House and in Westminster. Biden and Sunak are both actors as well. Not, you know, there's sort of a different type of actor, more of a role player, like a LARP, live action role player, animatronic Biden, and then Sunak. I don't know what to make of this guy, other than it's like literally a technocrat. So from the central banking cartels. So I mean, but Rick, I don't know if you want to.
When rhetoric is used, you've got to look at the rhetoric that's been used right off the bat. Till the last man, we will fight till the last man. We cannot lose against Russia. We will not stop until Russia is defeated. All these statements have been made on the world stage very publicly by NATO leaders, in inverted commas, by the like of Biden, by the like of Sunak, and as aided and abetted by this plethora of D-list Hollywood celebrities who are also pushing, saying, till the last man, we shall fight Ukraine, Slava Ukraine, victory to Ukraine. Nancy Pelosi even tries to mouth that out when she was in Congress. This is the mantra, Ukraine must win. When you make that kind of a statement on the world stage, you can't back down from it. You can't be, we're not quitting until the last man, we will not stop until Russia ceases, and then 6 months later have your tail between your legs saying we're going to sit down now and negotiate. I think, Blake, they've purposely painted themselves into a corner almost where they can't back down. They can't be seen to be backing down. They'll lose face, and this dream of sitting down peacefully with diplomacy, I just can't see that it would happen in any way because of the way that they've set themselves up in their talk and in their rhetoric and the way they haven't let it go. Sadly, I think that was by design. They don't want this war to end. The longer it goes on for, more quantitative easing, more money printing, more money being laundered over there. It's just one thing after another. They can't almost afford to let this war end, as in the NATO people. They need to keep it going.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah, just a
minute. Yes, well, we're about to run into a break. So, you know, we could, as I say, opine for hours. And it's, to me, what that says is, you know, NATO's up against the wall. They've pulled out everything they can. And we know that the central bankers are also up against the wall. They've pulled out the big bazookas and their version of depleted uranium, which is, you know, buying up old contracts and stuff like that. So in both terms, they're running on empty. But we can see that Russia and the BRICS and, you know, the global South are all realigning. We had the Kenyan president coming out saying, abandon your dollars. We've got Saudi Arabia pivoting to China with the oil market, which is a big move. We've also got Syria falling out of the whole pattern back into the Arabic, pan-Arabic movement. So we're seeing a global reordering, and it's really looking like if Russia, China, et al. Wanted to be doing something, what they would do is also continue this war to make NATO look like the inept organization that it seems to be. And don't let me be painted as a pro-Russian shill or anything like that, because they're all as bad as each other. Yeah. The Chinese system is not something to be envied. It's something to be resisted. But, you know, it's looking a lot more, and to bring up the specter of 1984, it's a very tired old meme that's being dragged out of its closet far too many times. But the similar thing with the Eurasian continent, these large continental conflicts that are permanent state of war, but there's not really a war. It's nothing like World War One, even though there's stuff like chemical weapons or whatever. There's no troops on the ground dying. It's a war that's on social media. There's a small, thin border, but it's not being allowed to escalate into this international actual conflict. It's a gentleman's conflict between superpower blocks.
Well,
yeah, but let's run to the break anyway.
We're going to take a quick break here. I'm with Blake Lovewell on the remote line, and also in studio with Rick Munn, host of Locked and Loaded on TNT. I'm Patrick Henningsen. We'll be back after these brief messages.
It's back. A new UN climate report warns of doomsday unless we give the UN more power and go full Marxist. Oh no, haven't we heard this before?
From Washington, D.C., this is the Marano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Marano.
Fire, brimstone, ticking climate time bombs, once again! The new UN IPCC climate report is out, warning about a, quote, survival guide to humanity. Climatologists are weighing in. Dr. Judith Curry has called the report pure politics, weakly justified, politicized. MIT climate scientist Dr. Richard Lindzen says we should, quote, do nothing about global warming, and instead says the United Nations is exploiting people's ignorance to promote fear. Well said. Remember, throughout human history, the ruling class has always tried to come up with reasons why the rest of us can't be free and why we should allow them to rule over us. Climate is their latest excuse. This is Mark Marano for the Marano Minute on TNT Radio.
Are our love bugs and companions. They are our pets, our family, and they make life better. When we face unexpected challenges, so do our pets. That's why we're on a mission to support people and their pets. Whether donating a bag of kibble, sharing an Instagram post of a lost cat, or welcoming a foster pet into your home, every bit of kindness counts. Visit petsandpeopletogether.org to learn how to be a helper in your community. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
This is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
All right, folks. Here we are. We're in the final stretch of the final hour here. And this is the important stretch because we're going to hit the really important stories here. I'm with Rick Munn, host of Locked and Loaded on TNT in studio. Wick, it's been an absolute pleasure to be having you ride shotgun on this live broadcast. I really appreciate it.
Likewise, it's good to see you again in the flesh, and I'm not stirring up my normal blue wall in my little studio in Lisburn. I'm in the big smoke in Belfast looking out over the harbor, and I'm hungry, Patrick, and don't forget, you owe me food, my friend.
I owe you dinner, I know, so we'll settle that score very shortly, but on the line as well is Blake Lovewell. He is a writer at 21st Century Wire, and also Blake's kind of keeping an eye very much so on the world of finance, the economy in general, crypto, gold, the individual investor. He's looking at the institutions. Mm-hmm. And Blake, I want to get to this dollar and CBDC issue, okay? But
yeah.
Did you guys know, listen to this, and I saw this exact same thing happen after 2014 when Russia absorbed Crimea into the Federation. The massive sanctions were put on Russia, and they completely reorganized their economy, and to the point where they made it more or less resilient against sanctions. So when this big hit came last year, which they were expecting, it didn't hurt the Russian economy or the ruble in the way that I think the West had intended it to, because they had already made moves and basically balkanized parts of their economy and made it more resilient. There's a pro-sanctions lobby in Russia. They're hoping, and almost they're joking because they say they want to go and lobby that the West keep sanctions on Russia because they aren't able to basically attack the ruble on the markets and get in and short Russia's sovereign debt or play around with the bonds market to basically attack the ruble, to attack the Russian economy, because it's been balkanized. They put a bulwark between the West and the East. So I saw this exact same thing, Russians saying keep the sanctions going. So that's what's happening now. So it's it's totally reversed, Blake.
Yeah, well, I mean, like you said, 2014 was one of the big events in sanctions. There have been off and on sanctions before then, but that was kind of the mark that we've gone through the looking glass on the sanctions thing. I remember lots of media coverage saying sanctions are the kind of the humane version of war, economic war. But now look, we're back at the shooting uranium at each other stage of war. But back then it was, sanctions are the nice safe way of doing war, even though they end up killing the poor off of a country and the elites always manage to skirt around it. But yes, I remember that even the mainstream press was reporting in like the comment pieces that sanctions on Russia would hurt the West. The hope was that the sanctions would hurt Russia so much that they would do what they're told or do what we want, so that the cost was enough to bear for the West. But the way things have happened now, we've seen the problems with the West's reliance on natural gas or even US interference in the supply of natural gas. There have been so many multifarious ways that the sanctions regime has just basically harmed everybody, because it distorts the markets. It distorts the price finding ability of the market, and it really, as I say, harms the poorest people all the time. 2014, after the irredentist cause of Crimea back to Russia, marked the start of this. And there were a few years when Russia was slim. You know, they were running on a diet. There were some difficulties amongst the population. But as you say, they've been reorganized. And I'd say since about 2017-18, they've come out of that winter, and they've reoriented their priorities. And Russia stands in a great position because they have real world assets. And when you have the economic collapse, you know, what matters is the resources. It matters the land you own, the oil you can control, the troops you have, whatever it is, as long as it's a real tangible real world asset. And Russia has a very strong book of those. They've been slowly building their gold supply up. And I think although none of us know who has what gold, we do know that Russia has a lot and has been building that up for a while against this backdrop of economic sanctions. And simultaneously, they have tons of energy, like more than they ever need, from natural gas resources. They've got very fertile land. They have no problem with economic sanctions, like you said. So it's really come back to bite the West. Whether it's by design or not, we're not sure, because it was the Clinton cartel, Hillary in particular, that was forcing the Russian sanctions. But then that did backfire. And when she went to try and do the reset button, that was a big gimmick that fell flat on its face. And I don't know whether it's just ineptitude. I don't always want to blame a conspiracy, though.
I got a conspiracy theory. When Hillary showed up as Secretary of State with the reset button to Sergey Lavrov and the Russian delegation, they translated reset wrong in Russia, apparently. I think that was her giving a dog whistle. That was the Davos reset. And Hillary was threatening. She was giving the globalist threat. That's coming. The Great Reset's coming. Are you on board or not to Russia? And that's my personal, when they said reset, at the time, I wouldn't have made that connection. But of course, after the pandemic, that's my sort of, you know.
Yeah. It rings massive bells, doesn't it? Like when you look back at that, you're like, oh yeah, the Great Reset. I mean, but most people still aren't in that mindset, aware of things like the Great Reset. And I've also seen recently there being, whether it's a bot-generated narrative or whatever, people trying to say that, the Great Reset's a sort of far-right conspiracy of this, that, and the other, and there isn't a Great Reset. Well, there is, but, even if we're not talking about the Great Reset, there have been many big shifts in relationships, because the Cold War did end and Russia became a nation, a non-communist nation. That whole war game fell to pieces. So trying to re-instigate that, they've tried to revivify defibrillate, put the electronics on the heart of that conflict and rebuild it. But I don't think most people believe that Russia is fundamentally evil. But when I was researching that MOD video, which shows the UK demonstrating DU rounds to the Ukrainian soldiers just last week, all of the comments are proud of our British boys fighting evil out there, and this is what the tanks were designed for. They were designed to roll into Russia and da da da. And there's all this sort of rhetoric, like Stalingrad never ended and this kind of thing. Like it's really bizarre. So there's so many different angles on this thing. It's a really messy conflict, and the economics completely bears that in the exact same way.
Let's talk about, Rick, where you're talking about the de-dollarization.
Yeah.
We got a couple minutes left, and I want to hit the CBDC issue as well. But what were you saying before? Just kind of repeat, because I think Blake might be able to weigh in on this.
There's been a little bit of telegraphing going on at the minute. I mean, like, the dollar's days are numbered. I believe it's not a case of if the dollar's going to collapse. It's just a case of when the dollar's going to collapse. And I don't know if you've noticed this or not, Blake, but in the last week, you mentioned William Ruto, who is the president of Kenya, almost telegraphing to the African nations, if you're dealing in dollars, you're holding dollars, now might be the time to get rid of them. We've had pieces on CNN and Fox News, I think it was, at least two pieces, 5-minute, very specific, condensed, expert clips presenting to the masses in layman's terms what happened when we moved off the gold standard. Are we on shifting sands with the dollar? If it collapses, we're going to go into hyperinflation like we've never seen. They mentioned the, you know, they mentioned, what was it they were talking about? They talked about hyperinflation, and also they were name dropping Saudi Arabia. They said the tipping point, and I quote, the tipping point for this is if Saudi decide to move away from the dollar as payment for oil, we could see the collapse. And when it happens, it will be spectacular and it will be fast. And then they also mentioned on mainstream about CBDCs. This will pave the way for a potential CBDC to be brought in and so on and so forth. So I think we're being primed, Blake, in the short term for the collapse of the dollar. I think it's at the doors.
Yes, I would say, oh, there's so many things, like you've said about 30 seconds there, but you know, we could write a whole book about this. The petrodollar, I think, is already dead. There's already the ability to buy Russian oil with rubles, but you can also use, interestingly, Bitcoin specifically, as well as other currencies, including Chinese currencies. The recent Saudi deal with China allows Saudi oil to be priced in yuan, as well as dollars. There's no dollar exclusivity anymore. But as to the dollar dying, I don't think that the dollar dies. Now, this is me looking in the crystal ball, but the dollar has a lot of cultural capital, be it there is no real capital behind it. And the way that the CBDCs roll out is not actually a overnight turn one off, open up a new one and call it, you know, e-dollar or something like that. They'll still present it as the same dollars. There'll be some parity between it. There'll be two parallel tracks or maybe multiple parallel tracks. I mean, there are already digital dollars. I mean, something like 98% of the dollars in existence are digital right now. So it doesn't take a lot of them, but they're not central bank issued. They are issued by retail banks. And the real, I think that's the real battleground that's going on right now, is between retail banks, where they stand on the pattern. I'm working on an article about Fed now, which is the Federal Reserve kind of settlement layer that they're launching. It's been going on for a few years, but it's looking to be building up steam. And some of the actors behind that are super interesting. It draws in some actual banks. And for one really interesting one I found was Credit Suisse, because we've been covering the various collapses of the last few weeks. And Credit Suisse was one of them. It looks like an insolvent bank. It's not worthy of investing in. However, it's still in bed with the Bank for International Settlements and all these different layers of organizations that are moving forward with a protocol to develop what looks like CBDCs. And as I say, I'm still working on this article, but what it relies on fundamentally is everyone uses the same language. And by language, they don't mean English or Japanese. What they mean is like a programming language. It's ISO 20022. Now, you know, this may come down the line. You'll realize how important that is. But the various different companies, groups, organizations include the EU Commission in there. I'm blurring out way too much information about it, but so if they all use the same regulatory framework, then you can have multiple different CBDCs launched at various different times, but they all operate under the same aegis. So I don't think we're going to see a global coin. I think the IMF will have its own role with its special drawing rights, but what I think we'll see is this slow accretion of different national efforts, but I don't think the nation state exists anymore, but that's going to be the aegis that they push the CBDCs into. And there is, may I say, a massive tie-in with cryptocurrencies, and that isn't Bitcoin or the anonymous cryptocurrencies that you can use for drug dealing. These are cryptocurrencies like Ripple and stablecoins like USDC. Those will play a massive role at providing some of the technological layers for allowing intra-bank, inter-bank, international liquidity, as well as tokenization. And one thing that, you know, is mentioned in alternative media, kind of the surveillance aspect or the control aspect, you know, turning the dollar was off and on, if you've been naughty or nice, that kind of thing. That's really being fleshed out in the background technologically. And there's loads of different AI, machine learning groups involved in harvesting data. And so I think some of the form of these future currencies is going to be they automatically harvest as much data on you as possible that's available on the internet. This isn't just you fill in a form at the bank. They've already got a form on you. They've already got everything. All you need to do is log into that identity. And they say it's to prevent fraud ostensibly, but you know what we know, that's to prevent freedom.
So that's a digital wallet. So that's a sort of the gateway. So Bank of England, they've got the CBDC program more or less done. They're just waiting for the right opportunity. So I'm going to ask both of you here. We've got a couple minute left. Rishi Sunak or Keir Starmer, who's going to be the one to usher in the CBDC, Rick?
It's like picking a death by lethal injection or by firing squad, you know. Either way, it's going to be catastrophic. It literally doesn't matter who the person's going to be. But if you were to ask me, you know, if there was to be a snap election called now, I still think Sunak would take it. Keir Starmer is so weak.
It's like a dead fish, isn't
so
he?
So insipid. You know, if there was to be a snap election called now, I still think Sunak would take it. Keir Starmer is so weak.
It's like a dead fish, isn't
so
he?
So insipid. Oh. And that's saying something when you can set him beside somebody like Rishi Sunak, who's also equally insipid and weak.
Blake, Starmer or Rishi Sunak, 30 seconds, quickly.
Well, I would take firing squad over lethal injection, so it's probably going to be Keir Starmer, even though Rishi Sunak's already been touting the UK CBDC.
Hobson's choice. Exactly. You're darned if you do, you're darned if you don't. Thank you, Rick Munn, for joining us. It's been an absolute thrill. Really appreciate it.
Welcome. Thank you, Patrick.
And thank you, Mr. Blake Lovewell, for your excellent contribution this week. And also Basil Valentine, our roving correspondent in the first hour. Take care, Blake and Rick. See you guys later.
Peace and love to everyone out there.
And that's it, folks. That's all we got time for today. We'll see you tomorrow, same place, same time here on TNT. Patrick Henningsen signing out.